It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson joins the show to make the case for passing the deal that would replace NAFTA, which he says could spur medical innovation. First, over the last few weeks, the national news cycle has been dominated by one big story, kicked off in large part by a whistleblower in the nation's capital. While whistleblowers may feel like a modern invention, they actually have had a significant impact on the history and politics of the United States. Our next guest writes that one of the first well-known whistleblower complaints, before they even called them whistleblowers, occurred early in the country's founding and led to one of the earliest whistleblower protection laws in the country. And in more recent years, a number of people have released information that raised questions about who is and isn't a whistleblower, including Daniel Ellsberg, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, Reality Winner, and more. Our next guest recently took a look at the long history of whistleblowing in the United States. Allison Stanger is the Russell Long 60 Professor of International Politics and Economics at Middlebury College. She's the author of the new book, Whistleblowers, Honesty in America, From Washington to Trump. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Rob.
Well, why did you tackle this long-running history of whistleblowers?
Well, I got really interested in the whole question of how you keep elites honest because of a book I wrote previously called One Nation Under Contract. That last book looked at the privatization of American national security, that is, the use of contractors in all walks of government life where previously government employees would do the same work. And I realized that the line between business and government was becoming very blurry with the revolving door between the two creating all these conflicts of interest. And I thought, you know, we're really trusting our elites to do the right thing behind closed doors. Is that such a good idea? You know, how do we keep our elites honest? And that's what brought me to whistleblowing, because that's what whistleblowers do.
I think we'll spend a lot of our time in the modern day, but I do want you to take us back to the Revolutionary War, where you point toward the first whistleblower protections being established. What happened?
Yeah, it's important to realize that whistleblowing is in America's DNA. It's not a partisan issue. It's an American issue. And we have the world's first whistleblower protection law dating back to 1778. It came about because the first Commodore of the United States Navy, a man by the name of Essex Hopkins, who hailed from Rhode Island, was essentially abusing his public office for private gain. He did this because George Washington would tell him to engage the British various places, but he had commercial interests, economic interests, that made him instead take the ships elsewhere to serve those interests. So he was removed from his post, and the first whistleblower laws were passed in connection with that incident.
And a lot of the classic elements of whistleblowing, including retaliation against people who spoke out against him, were in place in that situation, right?
That's right. Remember, it's wartime. He's ostensibly first called out for torturing British prisoners of war. But the real reason was this misuse of his office and serving himself rather than the newly United States of America. And Congress legislated to get the whistleblowers out of jail after he had them put in prison for libel. They paid their legal fees. They legislated that all the documents related to this incident should be made public, which is why we know about the story today.
In the modern day, we use the word whistleblower a lot of times in a popular sense. Somebody released some information from the government or corporation or whatever that somebody else didn't want us to know. But under the legal definitions, not all of what we call whistleblowers are really whistleblowers. What makes that line?
Well, you know, it's a judgment call, but essentially the main thing to realize is that all whistleblowers are leakers, but all leakers are not whistleblowers. In other words, what you have to look at in whistleblowing is the content of the complaint. What was the misconduct? It doesn't matter what their motives are. It doesn't matter what happens to them afterwards. All that matters is the content of the complaint, whereas leakers just leak for all kinds of all kinds of reasons. They may do so for policy reasons. They don't like a policy that's being adopted, so they leak to try to kill the policy. But that's not whistleblowing.
Talking to Allison Stanger, her new book is called Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. You spend chapters, Allison, on a bunch of individual cases, each of which we could talk about for an hour or 5 hours for that matter. But one common theme is, what happens with whistleblower protections when we're talking about national security issues? So what that whistleblower, whether or not they follow proper procedure, is releasing dangerous national secrets that could really harm the country. How do we navigate that in our laws?
Yeah, you go right to the heart of the matter with national security whistleblowing, which is the most difficult. Because think about it. If you're a national security employee, you're not supposed to release classified information. But how do you possibly bring misconduct to light without doing that? So it's kind of a catch-22 situation. The laws reflect that. The Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2012, which covers all government employees and protects them from retaliation, explicitly excludes any national security employee. So that's a kind of precarious structure. There's this Intelligence Committee Inspector General system through which the official complaint rose and was turned over to Congress. But that's set up by executive order and another law. But there's some tension between the two. And since people in the intelligence community don't like to reveal secrets, there's a whole series of hurdles to getting those complaints into the public eye. So this intelligence community whistleblower is something of a miracle in my view.
Yeah. While there are whistleblower protections, in some cases in national security and elsewhere, whistleblowers don't always seem, in the cases you give, to be very protected. Why is that?
No. It's the national security realm, which is the most treacherous. But it's true for all whistleblowers. The standard pattern is really they're celebrated when they first do this brave thing. But then when media attention focuses elsewhere, it's another matter. They're retaliated against. They lose everything. Their family and friends are affected. So it's not something for the faint of heart. It's a very self-sacrificing thing to do in all realms, not just national security. But national security is the most precarious.
A common theme, again, that runs through a few of the different cases you give is, okay, if I'm in national security, I think there's wrongdoing here. I try to go through channels in one way or another, and I feel like my complaints are being heard. What I want to go to Congress doesn't go to Congress. Mm-hmm. What then? Is there any kind of recourse to go outside the system legally?
Not really. And that's why you see people like Edward Snowden not even using the official channels and leaving the country. I would argue that given the state of the law at the time, had he stayed and actually complained within the system to the NSA Inspector General, we would never know anything about his revelations because the man in charge at the time of the NSA Inspector General's office was removed from his position in 2016 for retaliating against a whistleblower. So that's why Snowden made his choice to leave the country and leak through the press to get this information to the American people. In my book, I say that he may one day be our first traitor patriot because he initiated this public discussion that we wouldn't have had without him. But he really broke the law to do that.
Do we need changes in our whistleblower system, especially in the realm of national security?
We definitely do, and I think that's one of the best things that could come out of this whole, you know, tumultuous time before us is to see Congress legislate and improve the system so that whistleblowers can complain within the system without fearing for their careers and their livelihood. And it's seen as a positive thing, a way of keeping everybody on the rails and doing what they're supposed to be doing, upholding the ideals they claim to be upholding. That's a pattern in U.S. history. If you look at the whole Inspector General system, the one that's in the news today, that's something put in place in 1978, and it's a response to what we learn from Richard Nixon's abuse of his office. So the same thing can happen after Donald Trump.
We're talking to Allison Stanger about whistleblowers throughout American history. She's the author of the new book, Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about whistleblowers in American politics and history? What role do you think whistleblowers play? Do you have thoughts about any particular person who revealed information, maybe especially national security information, whether they are whistleblowers or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about the role of whistleblowers in American history with Allison Stanger, professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College. Her new book is Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the history, the past, present, or future of whistleblowing in the United States? Do you have thoughts on any specific case? Edward Snowden, Daniel Ellsberg, the current whistleblower case, TBD, who that is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I wanted to ask, Allison, this current whistleblower, now apparently there's a second one, does it seem like they appropriately went through channels in making their complaint?
The second one we don't know as much about, but the first one we do. And the first one definitely did go through all the proper channels, just ran that gauntlet and did it the right way. And even Trump's intelligence community inspector general has said that the process was followed and the complaint should be heard. And so the second one we don't know that much about yet, but I think we're going to see more in the weeks ahead because what's happening and has been happening since Trump's election is that the intelligence community has been behaving in unprecedented fashion. I know this because for my book, I researched and interviewed all the NSA whistleblowers, including Edward Snowden, plus the senior leadership of the NSA. And what I took away from that is they don't behave in this fashion. They've only been doing so since Trump's election because they really feel that the president is a national security threat and he's failing to uphold his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So I think we're seeing more whistleblowers coming forward. There's one from the Treasury Department that we just learned of, and there will be more in the future.
And the argument from the president and his supporters is this isn't about President Trump. This is about the whistleblowers and the people entrenched in this national security or Treasury bureaucracy who don't like the president, who have a series of personal vendettas. So how do you sort that out?
Well, you just have to look past the spin and focus on the content of the complaint, which is how you define a whistleblower. And if you spend any time with anybody from the intelligence community, you know that they're not partisans. They swear an oath to the Constitution, not the President of the United States. And they're upset because the whistleblower complaint indicates a cover-up of both a national security threat, that's the shadow foreign policy being run through the president via his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and also the Attorney General, Bill Barr, that's completely at odds with the official foreign policy of the United States as administered by the State Department, and for which Congress appropriates the money. Congress approved that military aid to Ukraine. So that's unprecedented, and there was a desire to cover that up. But the second thing is the simple matter of foreign electoral interference. I think it's pretty clear that we want Americans to elect our officials and not foreigners. So this is alarming to anybody who's worked in the national security community, and they are responding accordingly, not because they're partisans, but because they're defending the system of the rule of law itself.
I want to talk for a few moments about Edward Snowden, a former NSA contractor. We've touched on him a little bit. Again, we could spend hours just talking about Edward Snowden and everything that came out of that. But what, if anything, did we learn about how our whistleblower system works or doesn't work because of what Edward Snowden unveiled?
Well, that's a really interesting case to look at, because when I did these interviews, you have these two competing narratives from the whistleblowers on the one hand and from the officials on the other hand, and they have absolutely nothing in common. So what I try to do is tease out the truth in that story. And what you learn when you do that is that Snowden really revealed a complete revolution in NSA operating procedures after 9/11. In other words, they put in place emergency measures because the country had just been attacked, and that was understandable and justifiable. But what happened is over time, those emergency measures became business as usual, yet the American people knew nothing about that change. And Snowden really brought that to light and forced us to have a public conversation about it. And Congress revised the Patriot Act in response. So there was a very real legal effect. But again, had he not, in a sense, fled the country and broken laws, we would have never known about that. So he really revealed a kind of creeping national security state that needed oversight, and some has since been put in place.
bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in La Crosse. Rick, hi.
Well, good morning or good afternoon. My question is, unless I've heard something wrong, is that whistleblowers and the information that they bring forward up until a while ago had to be firsthand. It couldn't be secondhand. And then the rules got changed very, very recently that allowed secondhand overheard conversations to be a whistleblower.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. There's been a lot of talk about that. Allison, is that something you've looked at?
Absolutely. Well, that's a Trump argument. It's simply false, and his own intelligence community inspector general has said that it's so. There, you know, what matters is the content of the complaint. So it's very common for someone to have a reasonable belief that something is wrong, and then other witnesses are called in, and you investigate to see whether the complaint has any validity. But there's nothing about it having to be firsthand information. The matter is the content of the complaint, and we should stay focused on that.
Rick, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Allison Stanger, author of the new book, Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. An interesting point you make in your book, Allison, is how technology has changed whistleblowing from once upon a time you would have had to transcribe your complaints by hand to Daniel Ellsberg, his friends copying page after page of the Pentagon Papers to now one click might blow a whistle. Talk about how technology has changed the landscape for whistleblowers.
No, that's a great question because you know, I even divide my book into two parts because I think it's such a sea change between the pre-internet era and the internet era. And one of the big things is just the speeding up of the news cycle. It's a 24/7 news cycle, so things are moving so rapidly that somebody can say something that's completely untrue. It's repeated multiple places, and it's hard to dial that back. So I see the internet is playing a major role in kind of confusing the public about what's really going on here. And it's important to stay focused on the facts and to stay focused on the content of the complaint and not the spin that is coming from political quarters. And that's what I hope to contribute to the debate. I'm a tenured academic professor. No one can fire me from my job for anything I say. So I really wanted to I hope this book can provide a context for dispassionately evaluating what's really going on and what you as an American think should be done about it.
Well, in the news yesterday on that thought, 90 former national security officials released a letter about whistleblowers. Here's a quote from it. A responsible whistleblower makes all Americans safer by ensuring that serious wrongdoing can be investigated and addressed, thus advancing the cause of national security to which we've devoted our careers. So that's from 90 former national security and State Department officials. What do you think, seeing a lot of people formerly in the business making a public statement like that?
Well, it's all of a pattern with what former members of the intelligence community and national security community have been saying all along about what they see happening. It really is a complete revolution in how national security is typically conducted, how the intelligence community behaves, and it's all due to President Trump. There's a real departure from norms, and some people, I think, would like to say, well, that's why we voted for him. You know, we sent him there to drain the swamp. But the unfortunate thing that's come to light from these revelations is that the swamp now seems to be in the White House. And that's the problem that we're trying to contend with right now.
And looking ahead in this current case, the president has mentioned and Senator Lindsey Graham has suggested that, okay, if impeachment goes forward, we should hear directly from the whistleblower or whistleblowers talking about the right of the accused to confront their accuser. So the whistleblower system is hypothetically supposed to be anonymous. Is there a point where it needs to stop being anonymous?
I don't think so. I think the ideal world would be you could complain within the organization and the leaders would be committed to serving the people of the United States and would take those complaints seriously and want to improve what they're doing. And if there's any misconduct, they would want to punish the people who are doing it. But unfortunately, we're in a different situation where things that would typically be seen as misconduct, gross misconduct, the president is openly acknowledging he thinks are legitimate. So you really have this situation. It's a watershed moment in American politics where you have to ask ourselves, do we want to uphold this long-standing constitutional system that has served us so well for so many years? Or do we want to go to mafia contract enforcement where there's no impartial justice and no constitution, no rule of law? So it's a confusing time, but I think core American principles are at stake. And this is not a partisan issue. It's an American one.
You write in your book that the Obama administration, Barack Obama, came into office talking about transparency in office. His administration was very strict with leakers. Is it possible to solve this problem when any given administration wants to keep its own secrets and whistleblowers kind of automatically become a partisan issue depending on which party's in power?
Yeah, so that's the real problem. We've got to really restore a sense of civic duty and understand that whistleblowers are trying to keep us true to our ideals, and they're trying to ensure that the system is working for all Americans, not just for the elites. So that's what whistleblowers sacrifice themselves for the public interest in some sense, and they are valuable assets in American democracy and have been for over 200 years.
In our last few moments, the news is coming at us really quickly these last couple of weeks, last few days for that matter. What are you watching for next as this current whistleblower story goes on?
Well, the thing that I think we should keep your eye on is what's happening in Europe, actually, because today the European Commission officially ratified comprehensive whistleblower protection for the European Union, and member states now have to make it national law in 2 years' time. And that's interesting because a lot of these corruption cases and money laundering run through countries in Europe, which means it's possible we'll have some European whistleblowers who will bring interesting information to light on the current situation.
Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That's Allison Stanger, professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College. She's the author of the new book we've been talking about, Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. She joined us to talk about the role whistleblowers have played in American history from the Revolutionary War era to the latest headlines. Coming up after the news, we talked to former Governor Tommy Thompson about why he says the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, the replacement to NAFTA, would be a good thing for medical research and innovation. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, near record high water levels could mean trouble for cities on the Great Lakes this winter. We'll look at the threats to infrastructure and what those communities are doing about them. First, impeachment is the big story in Washington right now. That means a lot of the other business of Congress is getting less attention. That includes a deal to replace NAFTA, the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. The deal is being debated in the U.S. House of Representatives and eventually needs approval from both chambers. In a recent op-ed for Fortune magazine, former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson makes the case that the deal should be at the top of our priority list because of the potential for medical innovation. Tommy Thompson is former U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services and former Republican Governor of Wisconsin. He currently serves as senior advisor to the PASS USMCA Coalition, a collection of business interests and advocacy groups. Governor Thompson, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's my honor, Rob, and thank you for taking on this subject. You know, the United States-Mexico-Canadian trade agreement is something that is vitally needed in the Midwest, and not many people are taking it on, and you are in public radio. And let me just start off at the beginning saying thank you. It's badly needed. I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, thanks. Now, the USMCA, this thing's big. It covers a lot of ground from cheese to automobiles and beyond. Why? What does it do when it comes to drug makers and intellectual property?
Well, it does a lot. First off, on intellectual property, it extends for a long period of time the creative industries, 70 years of copyright protection for books, movies, and music. That's the longest ever, and it's just going to be helpful to any author any film director, developer, producer, and I just am very pleased with that because it encourages artistic talent to grow and expand, and it's just going to accomplish it. The other one, of course, is in the pharmaceutical industry, which I'm probably more akin to than even the copyright protections because the biopharmaceutical industry is so important. And this is going to boost the intellectual property standards in Canada and Mexico for biologic medicines. And biologic medicines, for your audience that are listening, are advanced drugs made from living organisms. And it sets the research and the development patent time 10 years. And so in order to do it, it's expensive to develop these biologic drugs, and it takes a long period of time. So they need some time in which they can sell without competition in order to recoup and recover their huge investments.
Right.
And so this 10 years is going to be very helpful to them.
Yeah. Without the USMCA in place, what's the current state of affairs when it comes to those protections in the U.S. versus what they are in Mexico or Canada?
Well, they're close to 7 years in the United States and in Mexico, and if they're enforced, it's much less than that. And it's really in the eyes of the beholder. So you really have to, the 10-year ubiquitous standard for Mexico, United States, and Canada is really a giant step forward and sets the stage for a lot of increasing research, and a lot of development of biologic drugs. So I'm very, very excited about that portion of it. I think the overall trade agreement is just very, very positive for small businesses, for agriculture. As you indicated, the literary individuals in the biopharmaceutical industry, this has got a lot for so many people that I just can't understand why we haven't passed it.
Staying with the biologic drugs, if I have this right, your worry is that under the current system, a U.S. drug manufacturer might release a drug, but then in Canada or Mexico, a generic drug maker could give their own version and kind of undercut the profits of that original developer. Is that your concern?
That's the number one concern, and that's why you have patent protection. And you have to have patent protection because roughly, Rob, you know, just for your audience's understanding, it takes you know, somewhere from 10 to 12 years from the time you come up with a compound or a biologic idea and putting it all together, 10 years before it goes through a tremendous tortuous journey through the regulatory and up through FDA to get approved. And usually you can figure it's going to be $1 billion to $1.5 billion. Expenditures to get there. And now nobody, if they're not going to be able to recover that, no biological engineer or biopharmaceutical company is going to stand around and say, we got to put more in this area and we'll lose more money. You got to be able to recoup your investment and then make a profit so that you got an incentive to do this. And that's why these 10 years has been set, it's been compromised, it's been discussed, and it comes out as the logical place for a company to invest and be able to recoup their investment and make a profit so that they'll continue to invest in this area in the future.
Talking to former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson about the USMCA agreement. He says it should be passed for a variety of reasons. We're focusing on the pharmaceutical industry right now. Governor Thompson, some people might be listening and saying, hold on, I keep seeing headlines about really high drug prices. Doesn't letting this patent go on for a long time, 10 years in this case with this international agreement, doesn't that allow companies to kind of overcharge for a potentially life-saving drug?
Sure, you can make that argument, and that argument is made all the time. And that's why the individual arguments were made to reduce the amount. You go in and you ask for 17 years patent protection, and you compromise down to what is the logical one where you're going to be able to hit that that axis of being able to make a profit and recoup your investment versus losing. And the negotiators looked at all the statistics and came up with 10 years. And so I think they did a fantastic job in 10 years. is a good year, and I don't think it postpones it or prolongs it to such a degree that companies are going to make so much money that they won't want to continue to go back in the market and get it. It's an inducement for companies to come up with biologic drugs in Canada, in Mexico, and the United States, and have some protection so they can recoup their investment and make a profit. And that's what it's all about. And you can make the argument, but I don't think the argument holds much water when you look at the statistics and find out that 10 years is really where it starts getting burdening to the consumer and has to pay more. The 10 years is sort of the break-even point for companies to get their investment back and to make a profit.
With your background, working on health issues a lot here in Wisconsin and in the nation's capital, do you have thoughts on other ways to tackle the cost of prescription drug prices? We have people across the political spectrum saying we need to do something. What do you think we need to do?
It takes leadership, Rob. It takes some, you know. There's a lot of people that think we should start negotiating directly with the companies and like the Department of Defense does and the Veterans Department does with pharmaceutical drugs. There's a huge argument for that, and Alex Azar and other people in the administration have been looking at that. There's other ways in which you can negotiate in, as far as having companies pay this, can only charge their best price to consumers. There are many ways to handle it, but you got to realize, you know, that America is the only place that these drugs are being produced. And I always tell people that will want to really learn this subject. You know, my wife and daughter and mother-in-law, both my daughters have had breast cancer. And I can't wait that we're going to come up with a drug soon that's going to be able to be given to women that be able to prevent breast cancer. My two younger brothers have died of pancreatic cancer. I can't wait. When my brother was dying, he says, "Tommy, find a cure, find a medicine for pancreatic cancer." And I remember him begging me to do that. And I've carried that with me, and I'm out trying to find ways. And why I tell you those stories is because I want the pharmaceutical industry not to be hampered. I want them to be out there looking for new drugs to find cures. I will pay a little bit more if I can find a drug to cure breast cancer and one that will cure pancreatic cancer. And that's what you got to look at. Do you want these cures to come? If you're going to have those cures, the only country it's going to come to is America, because America is the only place the pharmaceutical industry has got an opportunity to be able to recoup its investment. And that's what it's all about. That's why you have patent protection, to recoup the investment so that you're going to continue to invest in research and invent new drugs.
If I can, I want to switch gears for our last couple of minutes. Back when you were in office as governor, you did a lot of work trying to work with the UW system. You had these blue ribbon commissions like the one that former Professor Don Kettle chaired and others. Do you feel like the state has gotten away from that willingness, that ability to tap into the resources of the university system?
I think you certainly can make that argument, but you know, it's the university's got to come step forward too. I talked to the president Cross and tell him, I said, you know, come on, you know, I'm chairing a group now for the university and for the president of businesses to come in and say, how can the university do a better job? University, you know, going way back in history, Rob, the university came up with breakthrough or laws like unemployment compensation, like workers' compensation. They came up with aggressive income tax, which I never brag about that one coming from the university, but it does. And they came up with their own ideas, and they brought them forward, and they set up study committees. We have, the Follett Institute that's doing a good job. We got the Tommy Thompson Center coming up with new ideas. Let's take all of these and come up with new ideas. And I have never found a situation where any political party has all the answers. I would like to be able to take the best from the university and come up with their ideas in order to find ways in which we can come up with solutions to our modern day problems. And we got all kinds of problems, but we're hung up on partisanship, polarization, and not giving anybody else the credit. I don't give a damn who gets the credit. President Reagan said it best. He says, it's amazing how much you can get done when you don't care who gets the credit.
We'll leave it there. Governor Thompson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. See you.
Tommy Thompson is the former Republican governor of Wisconsin and currently works as senior advisor to the PASS USMCA coalition. He's with us today to talk about his support for a provision of the deal that would increase the amount of time Canadian and Mexican biologic drug makers are allowed to manufacture a drug without generic competition. He says that would help spur medical innovation. Coming up, we'll look at how Great Lakes cities are bracing for what could be a particularly destructive winter after a summer of unusually high water levels. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Senator Ron Johnson was on television this weekend defending actions President Trump took requesting investigations in Ukraine. We'll check out what he said as the story develops. Now, after breaking records this summer, Great Lakes water levels have gone down only a little bit. That has many communities gearing up for what could be a particularly destructive winter when storms whip up strong winds and push more water inland. Not a great outlook for bike and walking paths, roads, buildings, and other infrastructure. Here in Wisconsin, the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel reported that lakeshore homeowners are reporting large-scale washouts of their land from places as far apart as Milwaukee County and Ashland. Some cities are now building up their defenses to protect from what's to come, even as they continue to rebuild from storms the past couple of years. Erin Aylworth is the Midwest correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She recently wrote about the threats posed by Great Lakes water levels. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Absolutely.
Well, can you give us a sense of how high Great Lake water levels have been this summer?
Well, they've been at or near record levels, about 6 feet higher than a record low in 2013. So pretty darn high.
And you talk to people kind of at all ends of the Great Lakes, from New York all the way over to Duluth. Can you talk about some of the stories you heard about people being affected or worried about being affected by the high water levels?
Sure. I mean, it's Chicago, it's Duluth, it's Detroit, it's New York. It's basically the entire Great Lakes Basin, right? And so if we just start with Detroit, for instance, they think the high water levels and the flooding that has happened as a result have cost them about $600,000. And that's, from endangered homes, stressing of the sewer system, that kind of stuff. In Duluth, they've actually been hit by three storms in 2 years because of the high lake levels, and they think it's going to take some $30 million to repair the damage there. It's eroded the shoreline. It broke and flipped sections of a boardwalk. It carried away huge rocks that were being used as breakwaters. And then in Sodus Point, New York, on Lake Ontario, I was talking to the mayor there, and he was telling me they don't really have cost estimates yet, but they've essentially had to plug water lines and then use pumps and sandbags to try and keep properties and roads dry.
And this is all happening in the summer right now. People are worried about what might come in the winter, you write. What has them extra worried if water levels stay that high?
That's right. It's because the lake can get particularly active in the winter. And so they're just worried that, we're already seeing these very high levels. You're seeing the beach erosion. You're seeing, properties that edge these lakes impacted. And so, when the lake gets more active in the winter months, they're just worried that that's going to compound the problem.
And this, the range you were just talking about, I mean, this could be an individual homeowner, it could be an entire city's water treatment system, could be roads. This is a threatening infrastructure really across the board. Can you give us a sense of the scope there that different communities are dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, just here in Chicago, you're seeing beaches essentially disappear, right? And then the erosion of the shoreline. And so up in the, in the northern part of Chicago, where you have a lot of condos that edge the lake, they're just getting pounded day in and day out. And so they're dealing with, is the infrastructure going to hold? And that's the question that a lot of these communities are asking themselves. And so in Chicago, they actually just did this whole thing with a team of drone operators where they sent drones up in the air to assess what's happening, what they can see along the shorelines. And the Army Corps of Engineers has actually gotten requests for their help from other communities as well. So, you know, I think all of the lakeside communities are looking at this.
Talking to Aaron Aylworth from the Wall Street Journal about high water levels in the Great Lakes and the threat that poses to communities across the entire Great Lakes. Aaron, that was an effort to survey the shoreline in Chicago. What do you see when it comes to communities saying, okay, we got to build, we got to do different things on our shorelines? What kind of changes are people working on?
Well, in Chicago, Maria Haddon, one of the aldermen in the affected areas, is of course talking to various entities, including the Army Corps, about what sort of engineering help they might be able to provide. And other communities are doing the same. And then on the private side, you've also got homeowners who have started to question what they can do, you know, what's within their wheelhouse. So I talked to a resident whose homeowners association actually recently agreed to a special assessment of her townhome complex to address things like seepage from the water that's coming in, and then, you know, fixing cracks to a private dock and just essentially shoring up their building. So it's not just cities, but also, private homeowners who are worried about this.
And did I see you talk to one city leader who said, okay, a lot of our infrastructure has been destroyed by high levels and storms, and we don't want to just come back in and rebuild the stuff that broke in the first place?
That is exactly right. I mean, on the north side of Chicago, that's where the most impacted areas are at the moment. We've had this problem for a couple of years, and so I think it was last year that that they had come in and they had essentially rebuilt like these beach piers, right? And those same fixes are now falling into the lake again. So they don't want to go out and fix the piers if they're just going to fall into the lake year after year. So that's what they're saying.
Now, you've reported again from a bunch of communities on this. We've seen reports in Wisconsin of similar problems. Talking to local leaders, do you get the sense that everybody's going this alone, or are they trying to reach out to other communities facing the same situation and come up with solutions that might work for them all?
You know, I don't know that that everyone is that coordinated yet. I know that they've started to talk about about what they might be able to do together. But I think that's something that they're going to be chatting with agencies, you know, again, the Army Corps and whoever else about. So I know that Chicago officials, the Park District, the city, Army Corps, and at this point, I can't remember who else, they recently had a meeting, or were supposed to, I think at the beginning of this month, to discuss what might be possible, you know, on a broader level.
Well, now here we are in September. Winter is coming. What are you watching for next on this story to see how communities tackle this and what damage is still waiting to be done?
I mean, I think we just have to watch what the water levels do. Do they remain high? Is there any sort of easing, which I think everyone is hoping for? And then how active are the lakes, you know, do they just continue to pound into the shoreline? And at this point, I feel like it's a little bit of a wait and see until we hear more from these Army Corps engineers and others about, you know, what they might be able to do. Obviously, anything's going to cost money, so they've got to, you know, obviously balance money and time and what's feasible.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Aaron Aylworth is the Midwest correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. We talked to her about the potential for storms to cause greater damage to Great Lakes communities this winter. Many cities are concerned about pedestrian paths, roads, and buildings taking punishment from near record high water levels. Federal data says those levels are due to heavy rain and snow over the last year. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently reported on how Lake Michigan's high water levels are robbing homeowners who live atop bluffs on their backyards. Essentially, when the lake levels go up, waves take away sediment from the base of the bluffs, causing them to steepen, and they become so steep that the cliff comes crashing down. They quote an Ozaukee County official saying they're watching TV, and all of a sudden they hear a big bang, look, and there's 40, 50 feet of bluff that let loose. All of Wisconsin is talking about the big win this weekend. No, not the Badger game on Saturday and not the Packers at Dallas yesterday. No, I'm talking about the dramatic final round come-from-behind victory at the Marshall Community Library annual trivia contest. The team I was on came back from a three-point deficit to take first place among the five teams. It was a team effort. I don't want to take credit. There is no I in trivia. It took me back to playing Trivial Pursuit at family get-togethers back in the day. We'd form up into two teams of six or so people each, and that I always think is the best way to do trivia games. So you can brainstorm together to have a shot at the right answer and sometimes to talk yourselves out of the right answer. Now, this is important, though. I dropped the ball on one question. I should have known it from doing the show last week. The question was, what was a nickname for supporters of President James K. Polk? I had seen the answer just last week in the Wisconsin State Journal, and it turns out the question writer for this trivia contest had seen the same article. I even talked about the article on the air. The Journal reprinted it from the 1830s. It was about bears showing up all over Dane County. I didn't mention on the air that the article said a bear had scared a supporter of James Polk, and the article used the nickname that would have gotten me the right answer. I knew I'd seen it. And I blanked. That's the bad news. The good news is we still had enough answers to win. And by the way, the answer to that question, that article called the James Polk supporter a polecat. With trivia news you can use, this is Central Time.